This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Felon will return shortly with Season 5. The new season is progressing and release is not far off. Until then, the feed will include a number of shorter episodes, brief examinations of individual cases and incidents that sit outside the main season structure. Season 5 is on the way. In the meantime, these mini-episodes will bridge the gap. This week, we examine three cases where violence was delivered, not through force, but through patience, calculation, and substances chosen for their silence. These stories span more than a century, yet each reveals the same unsettling truth. The most deliberate forms of harm are often carried out by those who stand closest. Case 1. The Poisoner of Richmond, Martha Needle. In the late 19th century, Melbourne was a city of quiet domestic streets, horse-drawn carriages, and bustling marketplaces. Yet, behind the facades of its neat homes, darkness often lingered, unseen. One such darkness took root in Richmond, in the home of a woman named Martha Needle. Over the course of nearly a decade, a string of deaths would shock the community, leaving unanswered questions, grief, and a trail of suspicion. Martha Needle was born Martha Charles on the 9th of April, 1863, in the small South Australian settlement of Morgan. Her early life was shaped by hardship. Her father died when she was still young, leaving her mother to care for Martha and later two half-siblings after remarrying Daniel Foran. The family lived in a cramped two-room house in North Adelaide, where life was harsh and resources scarce. Martha would later recount experiences of punishment at home and abuse from her stepfather. By the age of 13, she had left the family home, stepping into a world that demanded independence far earlier than most children would face. She found work as a housekeeper, learning to navigate the complexities of domestic service while still a child. At 18, Martha married Henry Needle. The couple settled in Richmond after moving from Adelaide in 1885. They had three daughters, Mabel, Elsie, and May. At first, the marriage appeared stable, but beneath the surface, tensions grew. Henry Needle was shy, prone to jealousy, and sometimes violent. Martha, by contrast, was described as attractive and lively, drawn to the company of men and social interaction beyond the confines of her home. In this atmosphere of domestic strain, a pattern of misfortune, or something darker, would emerge. The first death came quietly. On the 23rd of February, 1885, Mabel Needle, Martha's eldest daughter, fell ill. Her illness was brief, almost imperceptible in its onset. She died soon after. The cause was never definitively determined, but Martha Needle received £100 in life insurance, a significant sum at the time. 4 years later, Henry Needle himself succumbed to a mysterious illness. Following him, both Elsie and May would die within a year. Doctors were confounded, unable to pinpoint the cause of death, yet Martha, it seemed, remained composed, using the life insurance to commission an elaborate family grave, which she visited with a ritualistic regularity. By the early 1890s, Martha's life began to intertwine with the Yunkin brothers from Adelaide. Lewis, Otto, and Herman operated a saddlery business in Richmond. In 1891, Martha sublet part of her home to lodgers, opening the door for new relationships and ultimately the circumstances that would lead to her downfall. By 1893, she had begun an affair with Otto, a union opposed by his brothers. Lewis, protective and wary, would not approve of the relationship. His death on the 15th of May, 1894, initially attributed to typhoid, passed quietly at first, but would later take on a far more sinister meaning. Suspicion returned with the arrival of Herman in June 1894. He had travelled from Adelaide to Melbourne to manage his late brother's affairs. During his stay, he ate meals prepared by Martha Needle. The first meal left him violently ill. He recovered, only to fall ill again after breakfast the next day. 2 days later, while eating lunch she had prepared, he was seized by painful, violent cramps that left him writhing. Alarmed, Dr. Boyd, who was attending Herman, suspected poisoning. A sample of Herman's vomit was sent to the government laboratory. The results were chilling. Arsenic. The police quickly moved to investigate. Herman was asked to request another meal from Martha, a test of her intent. When the tea she prepared was tested, it was found to contain enough arsenic to kill 5 people. Martha was arrested immediately for attempted murder. Authorities exhumed the bodies of Lewis Junkin and the Needle family for further analysis. Laboratory tests revealed fatal levels of arsenic in all 5 bodies. The evidence was damning. Her trial, though brief, captivated the public. Lasting only 3 days, it presented a stark portrait of domestic life intertwined with murder. Martha pleaded not guilty. Witnesses described her meticulous attention to the preparation of food and drink, her interactions with the Junkin brothers, and her calm demeanor as the investigations unfolded. Yet the accumulation of evidence, the exhumed bodies, the arsenic-laced meals, and her calculated interactions with Herman formed a narrative that could not be ignored. Martha was found guilty and sentenced to death. In prison, she maintained connections with a small circle of friends. Letters reveal a woman who remained composed, if enigmatic. In her final correspondence, she wrote, "Try not to grieve too much for me." On 22nd October, 1894, at 8 a.m., Martha Needle was executed at the old Melbourne jail. When asked for last words, she remained silent before finally stating, "I have nothing to say." Case 2. The tea poisoner, Caroline Grills. In post-war Sydney, the suburbs seemed like safe havens. Quiet streets, lined with gum trees, and families going about their routines, rarely disrupted by anything more serious than the occasional neighbourly dispute. It was in this environment, where trust was presumed and appearances were taken at face value, that a most unexpected danger emerged. Caroline Grills, a grandmother with a soft smile, a plump frame, and thick-rimmed glasses, seemed to embody comfort itself. To her family, she was Aunt Carrie, a matriarchal figure, someone who baked, nurtured, and offered cups of tea as a gesture of care. Yet beneath the facade of domesticity lay a methodical, calculating murderer. Caroline Grills would become one of Australia's most infamous serial poisoners, her crimes exploiting trust in its most fundamental form. Unlike the violent crimes that dominate headlines, robberies, shootings, stabbings, her weapon was subtle, almost invisible, hiding in plain sight. Thallium, a lethal heavy metal often used in rat poison. Caroline was born in Balmain, Sydney, sometime between 1888 and 1890, to George Mickelson, a labourer, and his wife Mary. Her upbringing was conventional, her life marked by the rhythms of working class Sydney. In April 1908, she married Richard William Grills, beginning a life that initially appeared ordinary. The couple had 6 children, 5 sons and 1 daughter, but tragedy visited early. 2 of the boys died in youth. 1 contracted typhoid while serving as a lifesaver at Maroubra Beach, an event that would leave lingering grief in the family home. For decades, the Grills family moved through a series of rented houses while Richard worked as a real estate agent. Caroline managed domestic responsibilities, raising children and attending to family needs. Their life was unremarkable, governed by modest aspirations and routine. That changed in 1948, when Caroline's father passed away, leaving her his house in Gladesville. The inheritance was a turning point. While it marked a potential improvement in living conditions, it also coincided with the emergence of a darker aspect of Caroline's personality. Police later determined that Caroline's first confirmed victim was a stepmother, Christine Mickelson, in 1947. Christine, 87 at the time of her death, was the matriarchal figure in the Mickelson household, and her passing conveniently cleared the path for Caroline to inherit property. It was a calculated, deliberate act. carried out in the guise of ordinary domesticity. But Christine's death was only the beginning. In the years that followed, other family members and acquaintances began showing unexplained symptoms, hair loss, progressive blindness, neurological disturbances, and difficulty speaking. In some cases, the illness culminated in death. At the time, such conditions were often attributed to natural causes, old age, or misdiagnosed disease. The idea that these were not coincidences, but orchestrated acts of murder, would take years to solidify. Among Caroline's victims were Angelina Thomas, a relative by marriage, who had bequeathed her Blue Mountains holiday home to Caroline and Richard, John Lundberg, another relative, and Marianne Mickelson, Caroline's sister-in-law. Each death strengthened Caroline's social and financial position, granting her control over property and influence within the family hierarchy. Police would later observe a pattern. The deaths of those with financial or social significance to Caroline preceded the acquisition of property or advantage. The method she employed was chillingly effective. Thallium, readily available over the counter as a rodenticide in New South Wales, it was almost impossible to detect without specialized toxicological analysis. The symptoms of thallium poisoning: gradual hair loss, peripheral neuropathy, speech difficulty, and eventual blindness mimicked other conditions. A doctor might attribute these signs to malnutrition, diabetes, or neurological disease. The slow progression of symptoms allowed Caroline to operate undetected for years, each victim's decline appearing, at least superficially, to be a natural misfortune. The first break in the investigation came from an unexpected source, a vigilant son-in-law. Already partially blinded due to prior exposure, he observed Caroline preparing tea. Her movements suggested deliberate tampering. He managed to swap cups and secretly took the original tea to authorities for analysis. Laboratory testing confirmed the presence of thallium, a lethal concentration capable of causing death. This marked the first irrefutable evidence linking Caroline to attempted murder. From there, the investigation intensified. Police exhumed the bodies of suspected victims to conduct forensic analysis, a painstaking process in the early 1950s. Toxicology at the time was limited. Detecting thallium required targeted testing, as general post-mortem examinations would not reveal the poison. The presence of thallium in multiple bodies corroborated the suspicions of a pattern of deliberate poisoning. Authorities charged Caroline Grills with 4 murders and 3 attempted murders. The case against her was primarily circumstantial. Built on the chain of suspicious deaths, the preserved tea sample, and the trace evidence discovered in her clothing, on the day she attempted to poison her last victims, investigators found thallium in the pocket of the dress she had worn. The sequence of illness and mortality surrounding her could no longer be dismissed as coincidence. Her trial began at Sydney's Central Criminal Court in October 1953. Caroline maintained her innocence, insisting that the police had coerced family members into providing false testimony. Her courtroom demeanor was often bizarre. She was reported laughing during descriptions of the suffering of her victims. Prosecutors used this behavior to illustrate a cold, remorseless character. Senior Crown Prosecutor Mick Rooney described her actions as deliberate, motivated by a combination of personal gain and perverse satisfaction. She killed for the thrill of power, the knowledge that she alone understood the source of her victim's suffering. The jury required only 12 minutes to convict her. On October 15, 1953, Caroline Grills was found guilty and was sentenced to death, though her sentence was later commuted to life imprisonment. Caroline was sent to the State Reformatory for Women, where fellow inmates darkly nicknamed her Aunt Thally, a reference to both her familial status and the poison she wielded with deadly precision. Caroline's imprisonment lasted 6.5 years. In 1960, she was rushed to Prince Henry Hospital with severe abdominal pain. She died on October 6, 1960, from peritonitis caused by a ruptured gastric ulcer. She was cremated with Anglican rites, survived by her husband, daughter, and 3 remaining sons. The motives behind Caroline Grill's murders remain partly speculative. Some killings corresponded directly with financial gain, the inheritance of properties, the acquisition of homes through the death of previous owners. This aligns with the criminological classification of a comfort killer, someone who murders to secure or enhance material comfort. Yet not all victims provided such benefit. The notion that she poisoned for the sheer gratification of control or for the thrill of secret knowledge adds a chilling layer to her psychological profile. Her crimes also exposed vulnerabilities in societal assumptions. Caroline exploited the perception of women, particularly older women, as caregivers incapable of calculated violence. The tools she used, tea, cakes, biscuits, were emblematic of domestic care. Transformed into instruments of death, the case forced society to confront the uncomfortable reality that malice could exist in familiar, trusted forms. Historically, female poisoners have relied on this blind spot. Mary Ann Cotton in Victorian England, Belle Genisse in early 20th century America, and Nanny Doss, the giggling grandma who murdered 11 people, including 4 husbands, demonstrate a lineage of women using poison to lethal effect. Their victims ingested the assumption that their caregivers were incapable of premeditated harm. Caroline Grills fits squarely within this pattern. The public reaction to Caroline's crimes was one of shock and disbelief. Newspapers of the period recounted the Thalian panic, reporting on the ease of access to a poison that could be acquired over the counter. Between March 1952 and Caroline's arrest in May 1953, there were 46 reported cases of Thalian poisoning, 10 of which resulted in death. The panic extended beyond her, including other high-profile cases, such as the poisoning of Bobby Lowell, a rugby league footballer. His mother-in-law was tried but acquitted, underscoring the broader social fear that anyone, even those closest to you, could be capable of lethal malice. Caroline Grill's case contributed to stricter controls over thallium and similar poisons in Australia. The ready availability of such substances had created a public health risk, and regulatory measures were necessary to prevent further tragedies. Psychologists and criminologists continue to analyze Caroline's case. Was she motivated primarily by financial ambition, or did she derive sadistic pleasure from her victim's suffering? Did she suffer from a diagnosable mental illness, or was she a calculated sociopath? While some of her killings were clearly advantageous, others remain inexplicable, suggesting a more complex and disturbing psychological landscape. Ultimately, Caroline Grills represents a stark warning. The outward appearance of domesticity, kindness, and familial affection can mask lethal intent. She exploited trust, turning symbols of care into instruments of death. The quiet suburban streets of 1950s Sydney, places that should have been safe, became the stage for a series of calculated murders, each carried out under the guise of ordinary domestic life. Her legacy is measured not only in the lives she took, but in the unsettling lesson that evil does not always announce itself. It can live behind a warm smile, in a grandmotherly presence, in a cup of tea, carefully prepared. The contrast between her appearance and her actions remains her most chilling feature. One cannot help but wonder how many more lives might have been claimed had a vigilant observer not noticed that day in Gladesville when a simple cup of tea became a weapon and a family's trust was exploited with deadly precision. Case 3. Poison Trust, the murder of Sam Abraham. In the quiet suburbs of Melbourne's north, life carried on much as it always had. Children played outside. Neighbours chatted over fences, and in a modest apartment in Epping, a family began its day, unaware that within hours, everything would change forever. Sam Abraham was 33, a husband, a father, a friend, a man who, by all accounts, lived a normal life. But normalcy, as the investigation would later reveal, is a fragile thing, especially when trust is broken. It was the morning of the 14th of October, 2015, when emergency services received the call. Paramedics arrived to find Sam unconscious, his life slipping away. Attempts to revive him failed. By 9:40 a.m., he was dead. What had happened was shocking, not just because of the suddenness of his death, but because of its cause. Cyanide poisoning, a poison known for its swiftness and lethality. Cyanide leaves little chance of survival, and often little warning. The immediate question, one that would drive months of investigation, was, who would do this, and why? Only 3 adults had been present in the apartment that morning. Sam's wife, Sophia, a close family friend, Aaron Kamalasanan, and Sam himself, a 6-year-old child, was also in the home, too young to comprehend the full horror unfolding around him. investigators quickly began to uncover a story that went far beyond a sudden act of violence. Sophia and Aaron had known each other for years, their connection stretching back to university in India. Sam Abraham had been a friend to both. But beneath this outward friendship, authorities would allege a secret relationship, a hidden intimacy, and a bond that neither Sam nor anyone else could have anticipated. Diaries found during the investigation suggested emotional depth, plans, and attachments between Sophia and Aaron that were never shared openly and perhaps never meant to be. Aaron had arrived in Australia in July 2013, shortly after Sophia and her young son had settled here. From the very beginning, there were signs of conspiring. Diaries recorded in 2013, financial transfers, even a shared bank account, all hinted at a level of trust and intimacy between the two that was kept deliberately secret. The prosecutors painted a picture of a relationship that was sustained over years, quietly growing in intensity, while Sam remained unaware of the undercurrents around him. The method of Sam Abraham's death was as calculated as it was cruel. Cyanide was not found in a moment of rage or passion. It had been transported from India, carried deliberately, planned for months, or even years. On the night before his death, evidence suggests the pieces of the plan fell into place. Sophia had prepared an avocado shake and orange juice for her husband, an ordinary act of care that masked the deadly outcome. It was Aaron who administered the poison. According to statements he later made to undercover operatives, he had waited for the perfect moment, a moment when the household was unaware and vulnerable. He spiked the orange juice with cyanide and held Sam as he slept, ensuring the poison was ingested. It was precise. It was silent. The investigation did not stop there. Surveillance, covert operations, and the collection of digital communications revealed the extent of planning and deception. Aaron confessed to the undercover operatives, detailing years of preparation. He admitted he had fabricated aspects of mental illness to shield himself from responsibility, a manipulation that would later play into his defense. Sophia's exact role remained murky. Her awareness was undeniable, but the court could not say definitively what part she had played in the direct administration of the poison. What was clear? Sam Abraham could not have been killed without her knowledge. Sentencing reflected the gravity of the crime. Aaron received 27 years in prison with a non-parole period of 23 years. Sophia was sentenced to 22 years with a non-parole period of 18 years. The court acknowledged the deliberate nature of the murder, the breach of trust, and the calculated cruelty of choosing cyanide as a weapon, an instrument that, in its silent lethality, mirrored the hidden intentions of the perpetrators. Across the three cases, the methods differed only in detail. Arsenic mixed into meals, thallium dissolved into tea, cyanide hidden in an everyday drink. What connected them was intention carried out quietly, with patience, and with an understanding that trust can be the most reliable cover. Martha Needle, Caroline Grills, and the killers of Sam Abraham each operated in private spaces, kitchens, dining tables, bedrooms, places where suspicion is slow to form, and where victims rarely recognize the danger until it's far too late. Their crimes forced investigators to rely on patterns, toxicology, and the inconsistencies of human behavior to uncover truths that, for a time, were buried beneath routine.
Two lovers so desperate to be together, they committed murder. Kamalasanan orchestrated the modern-day Shakespearean tragedy, killing the husband of the woman he longed to be with.
Sam Abraham was a young man sleeping in bed at home with his son when he was killed by the use of poison.
Sneaking into the family's Epping unit in October 2015, he first laced a smoothie with sleeping pills and gave the 33-year-old the deadly drink.
Given Sam Abraham the cyanide in some orange juice by holding him and making him drink it as he was asleep.
Felon, true crime.